So why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride, because we are going to have some fun going green.
And Abby said, you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a low-life.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against this. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. The general population again.
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only Stalinists would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party. Because I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get the communist dollar, gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
Welcome. This is the Three Left Flat. This program covers news, issues, thought, and activism, anything of my interest from a radical left perspective for the curious or committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. This show is for going in a different direction. I always like kind of covering news a month out or a few weeks after the fact, because there's more details that come out about things, and it puts some space to let the analysis ferment, so to speak. Take news in a more slower way so that we can kind of take in the effects of things and not just in the moment. I mean, you know, we talk about living in the moment, living fully and being well-rounded. There's a slowness. You know, we talk about, you know, so slow food, slow growth, kind of slow down, you know, the pace of change and whatnot, this so-called progress of ours. But modern progress, not human progress, in my opinion. This show, I will, again, for the first half of this episode, I'll go over why the status quo and these strategies of working within the Democratic Party are a complete dead end. Not what we need for this moment. Okay, so there are arguments about incremental change, but this is not the time for incremental change. This is the time for fundamental change. If not, there are dire consequences. We are fighting for our lives. And then I'll go into Green Party and what would it take for the Green Party to be, as some people want it to be, viable before they join or go third party, if they're going to be electoral in their activism or just thinking about it. So first, I talked about this in previous episodes about the Green New Deal, but it was a quick overview of the differences between the Green Party's Green New Deal, who came up with it first, and have been discussing it for over a decade, and the five-person Social Democrat Caucus, headlined by Cortez, who will be mentioned quite a lot. She's hot lately. She's certainly getting all of the media attention, favorable or otherwise, but certainly getting the most hype. And I'm cautious, and I would like to point out that one should be skeptical when the corporate media starts hyping someone. Or rather, even if it isn't like hype is usually positive, if they're talking about someone like they're really important. One person is not what's really important. It's a movement behind them. And unless the media talks about movements, it's kind of wasted energy. So we'll go start with the first story today from Mint Press News. kind of like to think of them as the buzzkill news source. Whatever you might think, progressive action is working, or you know, it's really accelerating, or it's really getting somewhere. Mint Press News will point out that no, the system is in fact intact, and whatever is happening isn't really challenging it enough. And so here's a big piece on that. Corporations see a different kind of green in Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. This is written by Whitney Webb. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal initiative was unveiled on Thursday, speaking from a month or so ago, quickly became the target of disingenuous ridicule from both sides of the aisle. A lot has happened to basically bear out that, you know, the things that are being suggested here have in fact come to pass. And I'll get into those details as I read on. In recent weeks, support from progressives and establishment liberals have been pouring in for the Green New Deal, a plan largely promoted by U.S. Representative-elect, now Representative Ocasio-Cortez of New York. The plan claims that it seeks to transform the U.S. economy in an effort to fight climate change. That would ostensibly push the U.S. from fossil fuels to 100% renewables in little over a decade. Ocasio-Cortez and others have claimed that the measure is anti-establishment and has been mocked by the corporate media. It has recently gained the support of over 30 House Democrats and won endorsements from other media pundits such as Van Jones, so-called Marxist, but is not. Jones, at the moment, is a senior fellow at the Clinton-connected John Podesta-linked think tank Center for American Progress, recently called the Ocasio-Cortez plan the smartest, most practical idea in U.S. politics to address two urgent problems, climate change and poverty. In spirit, that is what it is. For someone who has campaigned on upending the status quo and challenging the establishment, Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal tied so closely to her name, sure has won from the establishment, and quickly too. Well, that phenomenon has been touted as evidence that progressive agendas are finally winning on Capitol Hill. One need look no further than the text of the Green New Deal on Ocasio-Cortez's own website to realize that the real reason this plan has gained so much establishment support so quickly is that it is an oligarch-driven corporate answer to climate change, and a wish list for newer liberals who still control the core of the party. So, section one of this is that, at the moment, the Green New Deal in Congress is the plan to propose a plan to make a plan. While most media coverage of Ocasio-Cortez and her Green New Deal refers to it as a plan, the current version of that deal is not so much a plan so much as a proposal to outline how to form a committee in the House that would then create the plan. A committee which has now basically been sidelined and now no longer exists. So I think that this section here is in fact moot now. It's now old news because now there's not going to be a committee. It was killed by Pelosi. But on to talk more about that plan itself. According to a draft of the plan that was recently on the Ocasio-Cortez's website, the proposed House committee, quote, shall be composed of 15 members appointed by the Speaker, which would be Pelosi, who doesn't really want to tackle this, and six of those members. So it's just the makeup and how basically Pelosi's status as an establishment corporate Democrat is enough to create concern because she'll be picking those who's on this committee. It will be a corporate-led committee. And the legislation drafted as such says that it will consult with leaders from business, labor, state, local government, tribal nations, academia, boldly representative civil society, a broadly representative, and communities. Emphasis added on business leaders. Why do we need business leaders? They are the ones creating this mess. Why do they have to be a part of fixing it? And this piece goes into a lot of the buzzwords being used. This concern is further magnified by the recent revelation that Big Oil was intimately involved in drafting the Paris Climate Accords. You know, the ones that Trump got us out of, so it's a big talking point to get us back in the Paris Climate Accords. So important in fighting climate change. Did you know that a bit of it was written by Big Oil? How much? Big Oil executives were included in the process as consultants and observers, but saw many of the elements of their companies had written specifically appear in it. Another indication that there was nothing progressive about the Cortez-backed plan is the fact that it is stocked with neoliberal buzzwords that are catnip to modern-day American robber barons. For instance, the plan states that it must, quote, include additional measures such as basic income programs, universal health care, but any other select committee may deem appropriate to promote economic security, wink, wink, labor market flexibility, and entrepreneurism. So those three last phrases are, in fact, neoliberal buzzwords. For example, the term labor market flexibility is code for the ability to hire and fire workers at will, an exercise in flexibility as opposed to the exercise of corporate power. As Investopedia notes, a flexible labor market is one where firms are under fewer regulations regarding the labor force and can therefore set wages, fire employees at will, and change their work hours. So baked in the language for this Green New Deal is the same old labor neoliberal reforms that have been plaguing working people throughout my lifetime. It will be more of the same. Like, there'll be money for green energy projects, but all the while, corporate power will get its hands in there, and they're going to get things that help them out, as if they need it. The term economic security is likely to be interpreted by corporate Democrats and business leaders as a status quo of corporate bottom lines, securing their profit margins. Indeed, the term is most often defined as having a stable source of financial income that allows for ongoing maintenance of one's standard of living. Now, to progressive ears, economic security is for individual people and communities. But when a Democrat is writing it and using it, they're referring to the entire economy, i.e. Wall Street. It's important to tease apart what someone else means when they use a set of words as opposed to what you think they mean. That's why good journalism is usually about asking people, what do you mean when you use these words? What do you mean when you use entrepreneurial freedom? Are you referring to the freedom of capitalists to exploit people? Or are you referring to the freedom of individuals to start businesses, meaning they need access to capital, they need access to loans, cheap loans? This article goes on to talk about a timeline, how this timeline of this progressive Green New Deal is tied to the 2020 election. But more on that, most likely any Green New Deal passed in the Democratic Congress will include cap and trade, which is amounts to paying corporations to not ruin the earth. So let's go on with that. While the language and some of the content of the plan is cause for concern, the most problematic part of the plan is the fact that it is all but guaranteed to propose a cap-and-trade system to address the issue of climate change. Notably, the plan itself does not explicitly call for cap-and-trade. Again, so is there even there? But let's say when there is something there, is it likely to be cap-and-trade? Most likely will be. It's a speculation at this point, but it's something to be expected. Such as its call to decarbonize industry, that signals such a system would be put in place, as these terms have been used to describe past cap-and-trade systems. Another hint that cap-and-trade is on the table is how the FAQ section of the text states that past cap-and-trade bills were fine in the sense that they promoted cap-and-trade, but not problematic, only in the sense that the system proposed was not large enough to encompass the scale. Oh, it just wasn't big enough. Okay. However, the most convincing evidence that cap-and-trade will form an integral part of it is that Democratic Party is the fact that the committee will be drafting the details of the plan will be appointed by Pelosi. For over a decade, Pelosi has heavily promoted cap and trade as an answer to climate change, and it is likely that she will choose reps likely to place that solution into the plan. Now, why is cap and trade shite? When she served as Speaker after the 2008 election, Pelosi had created a committee on energy independence and global warming. It stood from 07 to 2011. It was disbanded when the Republicans took over. That committee was chaired by Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, who went on to author the Cap and Trade ACES bill that was so market-friendly it was condemned by environmental groups like Greenpeace. The bill passed the House but failed to gain enough support in the Senate. This past October, Pelosi told New York Times that she would revive the now-defunct Cap and Trade Committee as Speaker of the next Congress, so that's what she's doing instead of this Green New Deal Committee. But her agenda is cap and trade, which is corporate giveaway. Here's how. Cap and trade is controversial because it essentially enables industries to buy and trade permits that allow them to emit certain levels of carbon when we need to be cutting it completely. The system allows big oil companies and other fossil fuel extractors and refiners to purchase credits, reductions elsewhere instead of just reducing them directly, which is what they should do. As a result, the system has been widely criticized. We think we had a cap and trade market on the East Coast here. It's been a disaster because it's a market, and markets can be gamed. Creates complex and easily gamed carbon markets with allowances, trading, and offsets, and does little or nothing to reduce emissions, but often increases emissions instead. Thus, cap and trade is a system that would do next to nothing to address the two issues at the heart of the Cortez-promoted Green New Deal. It would not address climate change, as such systems have been shown not to reduce emissions, because Cortez is not in charge. Pelosi is in charge. And if you notice, Cortez endorsed Pelosi. The reason given was so that Pelosi would create this Green New Deal committee and put Cortez, you know, it was a deal. Oh, you got to make a compromise. But at the end of the day, it's Pelosi's call, and that is corporate power's call. Perhaps the most telling of all is the fact that cap and trade has been promoted most heavily by large oil companies. Indeed, it is recently revealed by none other than Shell Oil executive David Horn, Shell being the ninth largest producer of carbon emissions in the world, that his company's lobbying efforts were largely responsible for the inclusion of a cap-and-trade system in the Paris Climate Agreement. Happy day. What that means is that cap-and-trade is what the fossil fuel industry wants. It allows them to keep polluting and greenwash their activities as if they are helping, as if we're doing something. Well, let's wrap up with how this is just more greenwashing, focusing on Cortez herself. Given the extent that she has promoted herself as a working-class socialist from the Bronx, who went from bartender to representative-elect in a matter of months, the neoliberalism within Cortez's proposal for the Green New Deal Committee may be confusing to those. And again, I got to repeat, the Green New Deal Committee doesn't exist, and it probably won't. It's dead on arrival. Like, it has been canceled, and now it's just the resolution. The resolution for a Green New Deal, which is now being used as a cudgel. Oh yeah, and this mentions about the Green parties. When we promoted the Green New Deal, Jill Stein, it was framed as fanciful, fairy tale, and completely used as a smear. Clear difference in plans. So here's an example. The Washington Post derided her proposal to end all use of coal, oil, gas, and nuclear power by 2030, just as Cortez is doing, guaranteeing the federal job core points as promoted by the Cortez plan as a fairy tale and as poorly formed and widely impractical. But, in contrast, the Washington Post, recently called Cortez's version an inspiring solution to our broken world that actually is about fixing the things that most need fixing and a dedicated effort to preserve the ecological health of planet Earth. The Post's take on the Stein-promoted plan was not unique, as many establishment outlets in 2016 slammed it as being deeply unrealistic and technically impossible, among other derision. Cortez's version, however, has been praised by many of those same outlets as the smartest, most practical idea in U.S. politics. Political genius, they call it, and one of the most interesting and strategic left-wing policy interventions in years. I want to stress that they're talking about the same policies. When the Green Party talks about something, it's crazy talk. It's wrong. It's fanciful. We're not viable as a party or an organization to support. Oh, but if you do it as a Democrat, suddenly it's all very pragmatic. It's all good. That should make you very skeptical of that, as I have been since 08. Personally, you know, I saw this happening before. You know, when the Green Party talks about single payer, we're marginal. When Obama talks about single payer, he's a leader and he wins the election. But then the reality is the people who talk about this stuff are elected, they're in power, and they have their committee, and then the law is written, and surprise, surprise, it's all corporate welfare at the end of the day. It's all greenwashing. As Cortez has moved to the right on many issues, right? Because at the end of the day, the Ocasio-Cortez Green New Deal does not, in fact, challenge the Washington consensus, but in fact would strengthen it. The grip of oligarchy and the powerful moneyed interests of the American political system are not challenged at all, because her Green New Deal does not include election reform, and it does not include single-payer health care. It's a package. That's why it's the Green New Deal is everything. It is the New Deal is a set of policies that work together. You can still work on individual policies, environmental stuff. It's all together. They rely on each other. Writing off that, I'm now going to get a little angrier, because now it's not just the speculation of what a corporate Dem Green New Deal would be when it is done eventually, or if it'll just flop around for a few years and, the Republicans took back the House, or, oh no, we need Republican votes, and I guess we'll just have to drop half of what was good about it. 80% of what was good about it. I mean, eventually, you'll just get crumbs. I mean, there's all kinds of bills that pass our now blue Congress. Well, there was a blue wave. Wasn't so important to retake Congress in the midterms. Well, now they vote for conservative stuff every day. The price are crumbs. You know, little crumbs of funding here and there. That is the advantage of a Democratic Congress. So worth it. But here is a article from Paste magazine titled House Democrats Voted for a Natural Gas Future and Nobody Noticed. So with all of the rhetoric and the buzz and the hype of the rising Democratic Socialists, all five of them, and a progressive caucus that talks one way but very much acts another. This is written by a Walker Bragman, published April 4th. Last week, a video went viral of, and still talking about, Representative Cortez offering up an impassioned rebuke of Senate Republicans for bringing her Green New Deal to a premature vote the day before. A vote in which no Democrats actually voted for it, since it was kind of a really lame version of a, and it was just a resolution. So what's the point, right? But it was a cudgel. It was like, oh, see, these Democrats want to take your hamburgers away. Playing politics. It's just so silly. Clown world, rather. So this is about our constituents and all of our lives, she fumed. Iowa, Nebraska, broad swaths of the Midwest are drowning right now. Underwater, farms, towns that will never recover. Will never come back. And we're here. And people are more concerned about helping oil companies than helping their own families? I don't think so. Something that got less attention, however, was the vote the environmental champion and a vast majority of her Democratic colleagues cast 2 days earlier. Ocasio-Cortez had been one of the 224 House Democrats to back a bill that, if passed, would allocate roughly $580 million in federal funding over 2 years to public and private energy development projects in Europe and Eurasia, including, and mostly, natural gas infrastructure, pipelines, fracking, the like. Environmental groups barely seem to notice. The bill, called H.R. 1616, the Sierra Club told us that they had not even taken official position on the measure. But if passed into law, activists say the bill could solidify a decades-long transition to a natural gas future at a critical time. So this has been in the works for a very long time. Throughout the Obama administration, started in the aughts with the Bush administration. The energy bill back then in the aughts was about setting up fracking and natural gas future. Because big oil knew they couldn't just drill for oil forever. We had reached, in fact, peak oil, but not peak natural gas. H.R. 1616 was introduced by Representative Adam Kinzler, Republican of Alabama, early last month. Disguised as a measure to crack Russia's energy dominance in Europe, it passed the House easily on March 25th with a margin of 391 to 24, with no Democratic opposition, though 10 Democrats did not vote, including 6 members of the aforementioned Congressional Progressive Caucus. Oh boy, they abstained. The bill's true intention, however, seemed to be opening up new energy markets to American fossil fuel companies, enabling the easy export of liquid natural gas. So natural gas is piped from the fracking fields of North Dakota or Pennsylvania to ports, which are then themselves environmental disasters there on the coast, where then the natural gas is liquefied, which takes a lot of energy and because you're freezing it, and then it's put on ships, and then export it out. All of these projects themselves are a local struggle in and of themselves, all usually backed and pushed and supported by whoever the party is there. It does not matter. The only difference is when it's a Democrat, they'll give some lip service to being responsible and making sure that the regulations that are on the books are followed. Those regulations, though, have been pulled back quite a bit. So, in fact, it practically said so in the statement of policy for this bill, what the aim of it was. That this was, in fact, for expanding the energy sources and supply routes to diversify them. The United States public and private sector investment in Europe and Eurasian energy infrastructure projects helps facilitate the export of U.S. energy tech and expertise to global markets. In service of this aim, the bill resolved to provide diplomatic and political support to the European Commission and such countries as necessary to facilitate international negotiations concerning this cross-border infrastructure and develop accessible, transparent, and competitive energy markets supplied by diverse sources, types, and routes of energy. The middle provision is noteworthy in light of how strong the anti-fracking movement is in Europe. Thus far, four countries, France, Germany, Bulgaria, and Ireland, have banned the practice, while the Netherlands has halted it until at earliest 2020. However, battles are still waging across the continent, which raises the question of what enhancing the regulatory environment means, words used in their statement. In addition to U.S. political backing, the bill pledged early-stage project support and late-stage project support for construction. Natural gas infrastructure such as interconnectors, storage facilities, liquefied gas plants and import facilities, and reverse flow capacity. Citing, while it is true that H.R. 1616 could hurt the fossil fuel-reliant Russia, activist Pace spoke to about the legislation had grave concerns about what its impact would be in terms of ending reliance on fossil fuels. We are transforming our energy system to natural gas right now, says documentary filmmaker and globe-trotting activist Josh Fox. Lots of love to him. That transition will last 40 years. That transition has to be halted immediately if we're going to stand any chance of staying within reasonable climate goals. Fox directed the acclaimed documentary Gasland, nominated for Oscar for Best Documentary. In 2016, he even helped write the Democratic platform as a surrogate for Bernie Sanders, securing inclusion of language pledging to disincentivize the development of natural gas power plants. Disincentivize, not ban, not stop, not halt, just disincentivize, which was to him a betrayal, since it needs to stop. Quoting him, if Democrats are supporting bills that say frack gas and frack gas infrastructure should be developed in Europe, then they are flying in the face of their own climate policy. It means that they're encouraging a kind of climate denialism. It means that they're pushing another kind of fossil fuel. And it means that they're playing to the hands of these tyrannical forces that are going to commodify energy, whether it's oil, coal, or gas. So this is where I get very mad. Because you have people saying, these are Republicans. You gotta vote against the Republicans. They deny climate change. They are climate denialists. They don't want to fix the problem. What the fuck are Democrats doing to fix the problem? They've been promoting frack gas infrastructure, the bridge to the future. But as has been pointed out, and I'm still reading the article here, I'm just working it in my rant here, pointed out that while natural gas is often billed as a cleaner burning alternative to other forms of fossil fuel, most studies have found that it is actually worse for the environment overall. Through its extraction process, like fracking, the leakage of methane, which is a more potent greenhouse gas. So that's something that isn't included in the talking points that Democrats use about, oh yeah, natural gas, it's cleaner, the bridge fuel. Get us off of coal and oil. Isn't it great that we're going to phase out coal and oil? Oh yeah, it's so great. I can really see it happening. I can feel it in my life. And here in New York, replacing all the power plants or building new ones that burn natural gas. And let me remind you what that means. As Josh Fox pointed out, it means we're going to be burning natural gas for all our heating, for most of our power, for 40 years. Now, maybe we're at renewables. They're climbing. It's about 11%. You know, how much longer is it going to take before we're half renewables? We need to be all renewables. What is the plan for that? The plan is to phase to renewables in 40 years. That's what the plan is. Because as far as what's being built, what's being proposed, what's being funded, what's being approved by our governments is more burning of fossil fuels, not less. And that is not as what is realistic. That is not taking climate change seriously, because it is running away from us right now. That is more natural disasters, more frequently, more extreme weather. To quote Texas-based environmental activist Sharon Wilson, who is widely known as Texas Sharon, shares Fox's concerns and perhaps outrage. Here's her quote. I like it. "I don't understand what lawmakers don't get about climate crisis and uninhabitable planet," she told Pace, pointing out the need for fossil fuels is quickly dwindling in light of investments in renewable energy. Quote, "If you're trying to get back at Russia and help the whole world move forward with renewable energy, because that's what people want, they don't want to stay stuck on oil and gas. Help the world move forward with renewable energy. Because what can Russia do about that? They can't control the sun. They can't control the wind." Wilson, a senior organizer for the group Earthworks, has been documenting fossil fuel pollution with infrared cameras in the industrialized Permian Basin for months in a hope of forcing regulatory action. Fool's hope, for the most part. She told Pace that she has been seen firsthand the rapid, unsafe expansion of natural gas exploration to meet the demand for exports. They're putting pipelines all over Texas to export oil and gas that will not benefit Americans. It will not benefit Texas. It will come at the expense of our water, our air, and that drilling waste will be all over the place. It all has to stop. Today, ending fossil fuel industry seems a long way off. While its dominance in the energy market may be declining ever so slightly, it has ties to Washington that run deep on both sides of the aisle. In fact, Democrats have for years been receptive to and pushed the dubious claims of natural gas being cleaner, and although the party has been moving left, at least in rhetoric, even the ambitious Green New Deal notably does not contain any prohibition on new natural gas development. I'm going to reiterate that. The Green New Deal doesn't even call to end the burning of fossil fuels, right? It's a long transition. It's going to take my entire lifetime, apparently. But we don't have that. We have 12 years. As the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has released, we have 12 years if we are to be kept below the 1.5 degree rise. We're currently at 1 degree. Polar vortexes, stronger hurricanes, bigger floods, more flooding. That's just 1 degree. We're on track to be 2, 2.5, 3. There's no limit because we're only burning more. We're only producing more carbon. And we can take it back in. We can take it back in, but we gotta reverse everything, right? Because taking carbon out of the atmosphere means, yes, planting more trees. It means having more biomass, having more ecology everywhere. That means stopping extraction, stopping the machine, so to speak. It has to be transitioned away from the machine. We're just building a different machine, or it's the same machine, but it's gonna run on gas. Steampunk. Instead of steampunk, we're going to diesel punk. Okay. For the most part, last section here that is an article from the New Republic titled, "The Democrats Stole the Green Party's Best Idea." So I'm going to pivot back to the Green New Deal, Democratic Green New Deal. This is written by Emily Atkin, published February 22nd. The Green New Deal used to be the Eco-Socialist Party's signature proposal, and it still is. Now the Greens, without Jill Stein, are trying to find their voice. Now, of course, they're going to frame some things that I disagree with, and I'm going to point out the points brought up by a rebuttal written by Kevin Zeese. I'll be linking that as well. I'm not going to read directly from it. I basically just condensed down his points of rebuttal, and I'm going to bring them up as I read through this. because it's going to frame things, because it has a thesis here that now that the Dems are touting a Green New Deal, why do we need the Green Party? Or is the Green Party still relevant? And remember, we very much are, because, as I've just explained, it's smoke and mirrors when the Democrats shift left, okay? Because five new reps that are Democratic Socialists isn't a sea change. It isn't really even a movement, since these are representatives from solid blue territories in which the corporate Dem who was the former rep was so bad that then, to most Democrats, the Democratic Socialist then becomes the lesser evil. Like, okay, I am willing to vote for someone new because the corporate Dem is just that bad and they've been safe and they're being challenged in a primary. That's what it took. Now, it's said that because, you know, Democratic Socialist policies are popular, they are, you know, in all polling, most polling, they are more popular, but that still, you know, the things to overcome are gerrymandered districts and all of the ways that barriers are put in place to actually kind of have sea changes, to actually have real fundamental change through electing new people. And I went through last week all the ways that that's probably a misnomer in the first place. So it's moot. Okay, but let's get into the New Republic article. Back to Ocasio-Cortez. Such buzz, such type. She's got to be the front of every article. The wunderkind of congressman from New York has been getting most of the credit for the Green New Deal, as far as this established media is concerned. An ambitious plan to fight global warming that has become increasingly popular among Democrats. But Howie Hawkins wants you to set this record straight. A lot of people think AOC thought it up, he told me by phone Wednesday, but I'm the original Green New Dealer. He goes on to describe Hawkins. 66-year-old Green Party member from New York says he was the first American political candidate to run on the promise of a Green New Deal. He was. This is his run in 2010, and it was seeing him in that debate personally that got me turned on to the Green Party and made me think about how, you know what, I like what he's saying a lot more, and I should probably vote for what I want. He proposed a plan to fight climate change with the same urgency and speed and commitment of resources that our country demonstrated in converting war production for World War II, which, by the way, what he means by that is nationalizing industry. Not all of it, but enough of it. To reduce New York's carbon emissions to net zero over 10 years, Hawkins' plan would devote resources to create jobs in renewable energy, public transit, and organic agriculture. And that's something that's usually left out. Is that mentioned in the corporate Green New Deal? Changing farming? Breaking big agro? Because, as it's been pointed out, a large portion of greenhouse gas emissions come from meat production. It comes from the oil-based farming process of big agro, in the fertilizers, in everything. Some Greens are now irked at the Democrats' attempt, more than irked, to claim ownership of the idea. Quote, it's a little frustrating to not have a dialogue between those of us who have been working on the Green New Deal for quite some time and the people who want to keep it solely in the realm of the Democratic Party, said Ian Schlachman, Baltimore-based Green Party member who is running for president. There are some Democrats who acknowledge the existence of third parties and independents. Congresswoman Cortez is not one of those people. So this article is pretty good in A, pointing out that the Green New Deal is from the Green Party, and we've been pushing for it, and if anything, it's now being talked about by Democrats because we've been talking about it, even though we've been called not viable and so on. But really, we exist to push from the left. Even if we're not winning congressional races, we have the policies. Hawkins, who told me he's launching Presidential Exploratory Committee, but he's happy that Green New Deal has become mainstream because now the Green Party can expose the Democrats for the corporatists they truly are, as is always our role. It's our opportunity to explain how the Democratic establishment has chopped it to pieces. The question is whether the public will listen. Now, of course, the public can't listen, find it difficult to listen to the Green Party, because A, we're not reported enough, and we're not reported seriously. It does not help when, say, the late night comedians or the news shows, when they talked about Jill Stein, it was always to debunk what a crackpot she was. to slander her. Not all coverage is good coverage, especially when it's just for a one-week cycle. I think maybe if it was all bad coverage, but it was a drumbeat that was actually insistent, because like with Trump, even if it's all bad news, if the media keeps talking about someone or something, then there's got to be something to it. It's more important. It's important, you know? So if Jill Stein was, if they kept slandering her every week on a regular basis, then maybe there would be more talk about her. Like, well, I guess she's important then. I mean, I'm always starved for the progressives and fellow socialists to talk about the Green Party, to discuss us. Like, why aren't they Greens? Why don't they support the Green Party? Even as, like, as an electoral vehicle, whatever. And I'm always disappointed because when they ever do, their critique is so superficial. It comes down to we're not viable. But the DSA is. I'm electing a few congresspeople. That's a viable strategy for the long term. I mean, there's a spectrum of how seriously they take themselves when they say that. Like, oh, well, at least, you know, we're getting something done working within the Democrats. But reality is they're really accomplishing very little. There may be people more aware that there's something called a Green New Deal, but it'd be nice if the media apparatuses out there would actually have covered our Green New Deal, and then we could have been talking about it earlier. But, oh, we're not big enough, we're not viable enough, so there's no point. Well, as far as the DSA is concerned, their movement is about the same size as ours. But they're just doing something different. And, you know, that's an argument in their favor for, like, you know, they're getting the media spotlight and all this hype and buzz, and the Green Party doesn't. But to me, that's kind of an argument of, like, well, then who's the real threat then? Because as far as from my point of view, you're being co-opted, right? You're being suckered in. Sheepdog. The question of whether public will listen. Once widely accused of spoiling a presidential election, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it doesn't feed into the spoiler effect too much. But it calls us, you know, we've been relegated to a political punchline. Oh, whose fault is that? Democrats are even warming the socialist ideas, so does America even need a Green Party anymore? Of course we do. So here's a point from Kevin Zees. The Dem Party is completely taking out the Green New Deal. It's not really pushing it. As I've described, there is no Green New Deal committee. It's just a resolution. Greens have been dealing with the Green New Deal for over a decade. And the fact that the Dems have to take our socialist ideas shows how devoid they are as a party. Mentioning Ralph Nader. So here's a little history. Green Party was barely registered, notice, in 96 when it fielded its first candidate and only made it on the ballot in 22 states, which is still a lot better than most small parties, by the way. But 4 years later, nominee Ralph Nader qualified in 43 states and won about 2.7% of the vote nationwide. Because he drew votes from Florida, the decisive state, blah, 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 spoiler. But Nader, among others, yours truly, reject the argument that he spoiled the election, and there's no denying that it established the Greens' legitimacy and influence as a third party. Nearly two decades later, the Green Party has lost some of both, though it might still have enough support to tip the results of a presidential election, and I guess that makes us important enough. And it highlights that Jill Stein is not going to run again. Her connection to multiple scandals, which are all just slander. And it's not even a matter of taking things out of context. It's literally taking what she says and then gaslighting, like, oh no, she's actually saying something bad. The scandal about anti-vaxxers is that I guess there's some Greens that are anti-vaxxers, and then it's guilt by association. But nowhere in the Green Party's platform, policy, or any of our rhetoric do we actually kind of say we're anti-vax. Just not true. Stein has suggested she won't seek the party's nomination again, so there's potential for a new Green voice, but it's not clear who that will be. So besides Hawkins and Slackman, who are pretty much the two serious contenders, there's also Dario Hunter. And he's about as diverse a candidate comes. Black, gay, Iranian, and Jewish. He's also an ordained rabbi, a former environmental attorney, and a current school board member in Youngstown, Ohio. Swing state. These qualities all make him an ideal new voice for the party, he says. Quote, If we want to cut through the lack of attention given to Greens, we need someone who has a loud and clear voice and a tough skin, he said. It takes a tough skin to be an openly gay black son of an immigrant Jewish rabbi. These two quotes endear him to me immediately, because when I was thinking about who would I want, you know, the 2020 election will be a meat grinder for us Greens. You know, we're going to be attacked on pretty much all sides. Let's say if Sanders is the candidate, you know, it's a tough position to be in, to still be like, no, we're the real socialists. So I want someone to be loud. And something about, like, Jill Stein is, I think people saw her as wishy-washy or something because she's a hippie grandma. And even when she's mad, or rather, she really couldn't be mad. Even when she's supposed to be upset about something, she just sounds exasperated. And it wasn't very endearing. Because, you know, it is the medium is the message. And she's just a hippie grandma. And so, but now, like, we got three men running, and we'll see. And this is after three cycles of running women, by the way. So why should there be attention given the Greens? Now that the Democrats have embraced the Green New Deal. Yeah, sure. Simple, said Hunter. This Democratic version of the Green New Deal is watered down. It pales in comparison. How so? Because, yeah, so something unmentioned here, but mentioned by Kevin Zeese, is that in 2016, we adopted an eco-socialist plank. So in our, you know, statement of purpose, Green Party says we are eco-socialists. We want post-capitalism. We want to build that. And we're going to use the state to do it, state, you know, because it's pretty much necessary. We need a transitionary state to do this, just as any transition of a society throughout history has required a change of governance. Let's see. So both plans call for universal health care, job guarantee. But the Green Party's plan calls for a full single-payer health care system, tuition-free college, and, importantly, democratically run, publicly owned utilities. Power generation needs to be public and thus democratically run. Because we have public authorities here in New York, but they're not democratic. The best they do is a public consultation, public meeting, you know, and only a few activists will know about it. Otherwise, the decisions will still be made by these technocrats. Greens say that the Green New Deal is the only version that's going to reduce emissions to the degree that scientists say is necessary to prevent climate catastrophe, because it's the only one that's truly socialist. Quote, quoting Schlachman here, the mobilization that would need to take place to solve climate change, to be reasonable, to actually take this seriously, would have to upend the capitalist economy. Hawkins agrees. You can't have an economy structured around endless growth. Growth has to happen on a basis as ecologically sustainable, and that will not happen if you leave it to market incentives, i.e. cap and trade and the like. The Democratic Green New Deal flirts with these ideas, but doesn't fully commit to them. It is a pale green. This is why we will run in the presidential race in 2020, is not to challenge so much as an opportunity to expose the hypocrisy. There is this growing cafeteria socialism where Democrats pick and choose elements here and there and put them on a platter because they sound conducive to running a progressive-sounding campaign, Hunter says. Continuing, if you are espousing Medicaid for all and free college for everyone, but ultimately still allowing capitalist interests to run amok, then you are not a socialist. It isn't solving the problem. You're just running on a platform that draws people in falsely. Now, calling Ocasio-Cortez a fake progressive is a risky game, given that she's one of the most popular Democrats in America. But it does seem like the natural place for the Green Party to go in 2020. Third parties, after all, are historically for people who dislike the two major parties. And although there's covers and Rolling Stone and whatnot, Cortez is not the leader of the party. She's the leader as far as, like, people's perception is like, we like her the most. She's the most popular. But there's a difference between being the face and being in charge. I think there's plenty of media that explore this relationship all the time. And I'm surprised people fall for it. Sure, there's an avenue for socialists to upend the Democratic Party from the inside, but there really have to be a war with their own party. And I don't see that in Congressman Cortez. This is Schlachman talking. I think if you work within the democratic system, meaning the party, you have to be incredibly honest about who the Democrats are, which is that they are pro-capitalist, very moderate, and don't want to move very far left to tackle the challenges we see worldwide. The chances of a socialist revolution within the Democratic Party are unlikely. Only one of the presidential candidates even uses the term to refer to himself with the modifier Democratic. And Sanders isn't even a member of the party. So the Green Party surely has to still appeals to those who want an American economy that is fully eco-socialist, which is, as they put, an inconsequential niche. I'm not going to use ever want to describe as inconsequential. Niches, sure. But it's a niche worth having. And that's not to say the party is without political influence. Mostly a spoiler threat. Even if it's not really real, there's not really the data to back up spoiler effects. But if enough people believe in it, I guess it's real. And then points out, this is the New Republic's issue here, that if it's a matter of Trump or a moderate Dem, and say Sanders loses the primary, leftist voters will vote for Amy Klobuchar or Joe Biden. Keep thinking that, we'll be knocking on doors, says Hunter. Because at the end of the day, Dems just want to co-op progressives. Any kind of progressive you are. A Democratic break is very much needed, and a party, and I'm going to talk about next, what's stopping us from being a mass party. And what would it take to change that? What would make the Green Party viable?
There's an election on again, and it's terrible to see. The farce they call American democracy. On the left is someone who is to the right of Tony Blair. On the right is a neo-fascist, narcissistic billionaire. At least within the corporate press, it's all about these two. The candidates who've got all the dollar signs in view. Meanwhile, off the spectrum is someone they don't mention. They don't think the Republic can handle the dissension. The only progressive you'll see listed in most states. The only one whose dares cost a couple bucks a plate. The only one whose platform makes any sense to me. The only one I like to picture running the country. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. On the one hand, a guy who believes in getting rich at any price. On the other, a warmonger who makes Thatcher look nice. Or you can vote the party that will bring full employment as it cuts the military budget by over 50% with the Green Jobs Program all across the country. So we can pull back from the brink with renewable energy. Because the future is clear. We won't have one if we don't have a government that can get the job done. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. You could roll over, play dead, vote for the 1%. And wonder in the future where your world went. Or you can go with your conscience, give it a try. Before Trump and Clinton kill us, we gotta kiss it all goodbye. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. I'm voting. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green.
Why Our Green Parties Haven't Taken Off, written by Bruce Dixon, the Black Agenda Report managing editor. I've met him in person. Swell guy. A solid majority of Americans polled want to see a third party compete with the duopoly. On a range of issues, too, the public is well to the left of both ruling class parties. So why hasn't the Green Party taken off and made itself a contender? The answer is a mix of internal and external reasons. The external reasons are easy to spot, they're immensely difficult to overcome. Republicans and Democrats alike have drafted laws in a third to half the states with an explicit intent of banning parties outside of their own, with particularly petition drives. In order to get on the ballot for a statewide office, or to just have a ballot line in the state and to run a candidate, you need to collect an amazing amount of signatures. Example, Georgia, for instance, requires 62,000 signatures of registered voters for statewide candidates, 18 to 22,000 signatures to put a third-party congressional candidate on the ballot. Texas, Indiana, Oklahoma, and Illinois are a few of those with the highest such barriers, none of which apply to establishment parties. It's important to know that nothing like this exists anywhere else on the planet. There are formidable barriers to media access as well, because all the mass media, the cable networks, and the internet itself are private property of billionaires and other greedy corporations, which are allowed to charge political parties and campaigns whatever they like for access for the eyes and ears of the public. This, too, is unique to the U.S. Many other countries, like the U.K., allow candidates for public office free access to broadcast media. And, of course, parties, campaigns, and careers of public officials are financed in large part by wealthy individuals and corps, frequently anonymous ones, the same forces that run both parties. The Green Party, then, is required to run every race in ankle chains, deprived of media and funds to buy media, and legally barred from appearing on the ballot in large sections of the country by laws which have been enacted and upheld by courts for a century or more. Now, many progressive movements seem to ignore all of this stuff when they complain about the Green Party or critique it. They critique the Green Party like we're just so fanciful and that we not seem to be aware of these problems, and yet, in half the country, we have overcome it. And, currently, there are people, like Bruce Dixon in Georgia, trying to overcome those challenges. We're trying to do something about the lack of actual choices. So it angers me and annoys me when we're called not viable. For a good faith critique of the Green Party, because I don't consider many other critiques to be in good faith, they're all very dismissive in my opinion. Now they talk about some of the internal problems laid out here by Bruce Dixon, which are very much hit home with me and is very much can apply to any other organization you may be a part of or want to be a part of. And this goes for the DSA too, okay? Just because they're, you know, running candidates in the Democratic Party, and for the most part, many chapters are skewing being electoral in the first place. And I think they're, if they take up that strategy, here's the critique that they're responding to. That the Greens don't have an organizing methodology. So what that means is we don't have a philosophy or a process or a procedure beyond for organizing people, rather than beyond the vague, woolly notion that political campaigns are in themselves the main and perhaps only vehicle for organizing political parties.
Because that's what the Democrats and Republicans kind of are. They're an association of candidates and office holders. They're not really a political organization per se, because they're a private corporation at the end of the day. Well, A, there's no there's no bar to membership, and thus, so neither does the Greens. And when they have a platform, Democratic or Republican, it's not like any candidate actually has to follow it. That's how you can have Democrats that are actually Republicans as far as policy goes, but it's just a matter of what the ruling party calls itself.
This, of course, is false for many reasons. Not least of them, not that the ruling class parties are profoundly anti-democratic, with no transmission belts between the wishes of rank and file and the shot callers at the top. It's a lot easier to be a Republican or a Democrat. Corporate media literally tell rank and file what their stands on issues usually are. By contrast, the Green Party aspires to internal democracy, to making its leaders accountable to dues-paying members. It can rely neither on the generous support billionaires or corporate entities, nor on access to corporate media. Now, while Greens have uncritically accepted the myth that taking part in electoral campaigns will win and organize a base, the Green Party's vague and woolly politics actually inhibit attempts to do political education beyond the simple notion that there are bad people in office and electing good people, like us, will make things better. That's not building mass party, mass politics. And unfortunately, it's actually what I've been doing, but I've seen firsthand how I am not building any base. I think there's other things to do, and base building is something that any other niche leftist organization says is what we need to be doing. And that basically rules out running for office. I say, don't leave any battlefield unattended. We should be challenging the people we're fighting in any and all capacities. And that means also on election day. In most cases, the law is that 5 or 6 people in a room can file the papers and identify themselves as the officers of a state party. Green Party's national rules allow it to recognize these parties. But what if it really is just the first 5, 6 people in a room who are now your state party leadership but don't have any real political analysis or experience in how things have got to be this way or how they might be changed? They're not really leaders. The tyranny of the most active, I suppose. The answer you get is a state party composed of a handful and most a few dozen activists who wear themselves out but have no idea why their efforts don't lead to a mass party. They adopt orphan candidates. They become defensive about their lack of success and busy themselves with fruitless listserv discussions and debates. By contrast, when unions, real from the bottom up unions, enter a workforce, as Jane Averly states in her recent book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, they know not to make leaders out of the first few people who sign their petition or express support for a union. Those first few people who come to you with radical sounding ideas are often outliers with no social following and no idea how to get one. They seek instead to identify and win over to a union's cause those they call the organic leaders, people who are already looked up to in a social structure or hierarchy, those of whom others come to for advice and counsel, the people who are and often would be leaders even if the union were not there at all. Win these people over and train and retain them, and union organizers have discovered that you have a basis for a permanent organization with a chance of resisting the many pressures an employer can bring to bear. McAvery book contrasts the organizing methods of Alinsky-type outfits and those of unions run by leaders that are in bed with management and with unions committed to standing, bottom-up democracy, class struggle, and standing with workers. It's the kind of useful comparison between what works and what doesn't work that more leftists should be tuned into. Back in the 1930s, heyday of the CIO and Communist Party USA, old William Z. Foster wrote a how-to-organize pamphlet relating to the methods in the steel industry. How does the Green Party expect to turn itself into a mass party without a few attempts at something similar? And a lot of comparisons and evaluation of what works and what doesn't and why. So without this organizing methodology, Greens embrace tokenism and we invite mischief in our meetings and stuff. So these are token leaders of caucuses. They get automatic votes in the national committee, and they're not responsible for following their own bylaws or contributing any specific or defined work. The Black Caucus, for instance, has such sloppily drawn membership requirements that they actually exclude anybody not registered green or nonpartisan, despite the fact that in 18 states, the laws permit you to do neither. Caucus bylaws also require annual elections, and they don't do that. It's a hot mess, as he calls it. And we also lack political clarity. Now, I think this might be changing. That's why I mentioned with the three to-be candidates for the Green Party nomination. They're all declared socialists. For the longest time, most Greens are in fact socialists, but they don't like saying so publicly. So the Green Party lacks political clarity about the nature of American society and empire. Being really clear about like what our vision is on the whole, what our analysis is of American politics. Lots of rank and file, and that basically is really confusing and makes it really hard to interpret what the Green Party is. So you have like people who think Green Party is just like just a more liberal Democratic Party or a less corrupt Democratic Party. So we are like the Dems light. And it opens the door to saying that Jill Stein, a doctor that works on public health issues, is an anti-vaxxer. Right? Because she wasn't clear about what she is. This is something we asked. So many others vehemently reject the S word, socialist, and anything connected with it as alien to their greenness. At the 2015 Green Annual Meeting, even Jill Stein, who claims to be a socialist privately, pointedly refused to identify either capitalism as the cause of our woes or socialism as the likely cure, to the disappointment of many. And this was a disappointment of me and my friend Colin I've had on the show, which he was at our state party convention in 2016. Colin asked her, do you identify capitalism as a problem? Could you ever identify as a socialist? And her answer was, I don't use isms. I just talk about the solutions. This is based on, you know, socialism turns people off using those words, using any kind of ism. American culture is such that people just care about the policies and they don't want a title or a label. But, you know, we're asking people to join the Green Party and have a label. So I think it matters and it helps. And it didn't help us that our candidates haven't done that. And that includes Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader is this, you know, profusely independent person, will never join a Green any party, has never actually been a Green Party member, which is why we didn't run him again when he would, but we basically said, hey, why don't you just become a registered member? We really just want you to do this. And he said, no. And that's why he ran an independent candidacy in 2008. And did worse, because then it was up to him and his campaign alone to get ballot access and so on. When pressed to offer even the vaguest outline of what transforming American politics might look like, the best Stein could offer on her campaign was that if a large fraction of those affected by various problems, here's a list, student loan debt, lack of medical care, those affected by the housing crash, those ill-served by money and politics, people menaced by police, suffering from gentrification, suffering from environmental degradation, and so on. Now, if enough people just voted for the Greens, they'd win. As analysis goes, that's on par with, there are bad people in office, and if we elect good ones, we'll get better results. It doesn't explain how the changes we say we want will happen. It's perfectly okay for Democrats and Republicans to be perfectly unclear to their voting base, or to deploy surrogates who don't hesitate to tell audiences whatever they might want to hear. Base voters of the ruling class parties are only there to turn out on election day and go home, but that is not a model that the Greens can or should emulate. Greens imagine they can self-organize with methods similar to the Democrats or Republicans. And that's how, and that elections, or rather that campaigns themselves build parties. So a big problem with the last few cycles is that the Jill Stein campaign, both in 2012 and 2016, fundraised multiple times over what the National Party fundraises. But here's the turnaround. Here's where we get right. And here's where this is kind of boosting Howie Hawkins and other Green activists, Green Party activists, worth anything, is doing so. So Howie is definitely the favorite to be our candidate in 2020. So here's the biggest thing that the Green Party gets right is its adamant assistance on independence from the two ruling class parties. They know you cannot ride the freedom on Pharaoh's chariot. That's vitally important. The best among them, like Howie Hawkins, at the time current Green Party candidate for New York governor, has also preached for years that a sustainable Green Party has to be built on a dues-based membership. I'm currently one. With all officers directly responsible to the members who pay those dues. And I haven't even mentioned, full disclosure, I'm the secretary of my local Green Party. The Green Party is also entirely correct in its consistent opposition to empire, gentrification, destroying the spoiling environment, entire range of disastrous neoliberal policies. But the party's vague politics, its insistence on tokenism, and lack of organizing methodology makes me wonder more and more whether it actually can be transformed into that class-conscious revolutionary party with a vision and resourcefulness to actually organize a mass following. The fact that there are a lot of people voting for Dems and Republicans than for Greens, and that Green parties have not grown more than they have, is not proof that the Greens are deluded and hopelessly incompetent, like myself. Oh, thank you. What the Greens aim to do is incomparably more difficult than anything the apparatchiks of the ruling class parties do. I've been a Democratic Party operative myself, says Bruce Dixon. I know. Will the Green Party manage to transform itself? Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. If not, I hope to be alive and active long enough to take part in whatever party formation, and yes, we do need that party, comes next. The lessons of the Green Party, like those of progressives, who struggled to transform the Democratic Party ever since the interwar years in 1936, known as the Popular Front, led most of the U.S. left into that hole, and will be remembered and learned from, not forgotten and wasted. A lot of the left in the U.S. joined the Democratic Party to basically get the New Deal enacted, and particularly defeat the Nazis, defeat fascism. But what that led to was a severe weakening of the left, and we've been living with that consequence all our lives. So if you want to know more about the Green Party, there's gp.org is the main national site. And I encourage, be a dues-paying member somewhere. You know, support an organization, make sure it's well-funded, because if you don't, then whether it's a nonprofit or something that is a good cause, they'll need to get funding somewhere. And if it isn't from members and from communities and people on the ground, it's got to come from rich people. It's got to come from rich donors or the local big corporation, grocery store chain maybe, and they'll have a stake in what that group is doing then. And they also pick and choose. And that is part of the systemic corruption itself.
Okay, so back in the last section of the Three Left Show, I'm just going to let Bruce Dixon, in his own words, because he actually has a recorded file here, tell you, facing 2020 and Bernie 2.0, what the Greens must do.
4 years ago this May, I was the first to brand Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders as 2016's Democratic sheepdog candidate. As I explained back then, and I'm going to quote myself, the sheepdog is a card which the Democratic Party plays every presidential primary season when there's no White House Democrat running for re-election. The sheepdog is a presidential candidate running ostensibly to the left of the establishment Democrat to whom the billionaires eventually want to award the nomination. Sheepdogs are herders, and the sheepdog candidate is charged with herding activists and voters back into the Democratic fold, who might otherwise drift leftward and outside the Democratic Party, either staying home or trying to build something outside the two-party box. End quote. 4 years later, that hasn't changed. Bernie 2.0 is still the sheepdog, running well to the left of the rest of the field of Democratic presidential contenders, beckoning to us, barking at us, to come on back under the tent. What's different now is that this time Bernie is the front runner, for whatever that's worth, 21 months out from Election Day, and most likely the most popular politician in the country. Bernie has a proven fundraising model, which depends on large numbers of relatively small contributions. His machinery has demonstrated that it can bring in the tens of millions per month it will take to field a national operation, and most of all, to purchase the expensive broadcast time and internet presence it will take to compete with the corporate-funded likes of Kamala Harris and the rest of the Democratic field, and ultimately with Donald Trump and the White Man's Party. Bernie pledges now, just as he did in 2016, that he will support whichever nominee the Democratic Party puts forward, even if it's not him. But some other things have changed This is Bernie 2.0. The Vermont senator has stepped up his game. His announcement speech, a half-hour CBS interview, and his performance this week at a CNN town hall in Washington, D.C., before a half-black audience demonstrate that as a candidate, Bernie has evolved. His remarks are now peppered with effortless references to criminal justice reform and mass incarceration, to the abolition of cash bail in private prisons, and references to racism and homophobia, all subjects he spoke relatively little on in 2016. Bernie did well among younger black voters then, and he will do better still this time. He will need to. Sanders is asking for 1 million volunteers, both as a fundraising base and to substitute for the party which does not want him. Remember, it was Democrats, not Republicans, that stole the election from Bernie in 2016, in Maryland, in Illinois, in New York, in California, and then afterwards and before in the media and on the Democratic National Committee, among other places. Bernie imagines he can, as Glenn Ford put it, steal one of the rich man's parties out from under the Lords of Capital. That's really not a new project. It's actually a pretty old one. It's a wall, actually, against which progressive Democrats have been banging their heads ever since the 1930s. In any case, some people are still committed to that project, so keeping up that fight inside the Democratic Party is their job. Some of us have a different job. If we can't hijack the rich man's party, we need to build our own party. While Bernie imagines he can hijack the rich man's party, some of us are about that business, about the business of building a people's party from the ground up. The Green Party, to which I belong, is faced with a unique set of challenges along that line for 2020. Despite expected howls of protest that any vote for, any energy expended on behalf of a non-Democrat only benefits Trump and his minions, and the very certain knowledge that the next president will be a Republican or a Democrat, not our guy or gal, the Green Party will have to credibly explain just what it is we are doing in the 2020 presidential election and how we intend to get that stuff done. With the right campaign and the right, or really the left, candidate, we can do that. Just like Bernie's people are hard at work 21 months out from Election Day, so are some of us. Here's what we need to do. Number one, the Green Party has to raise funds for and conduct a national ballot access drive. Thanks to laws passed by Republicans and Democrats intended to protect themselves against competition, the Greens are not allowed to place local and national candidates on the ballot in about 20 states. Republicans and Democrats have passed these laws from Texas and Illinois to Georgia, Alabama, Ohio, and beyond, which together require the signatures of more than 500,000 voters on paper petitions just to enable the Green Party's local and national candidates to appear on the ballot. A state-by-state 2019 and 2020 Green Party drive aimed at ending the bipartisan ban on Green Party access to the ballot will demand some resourceful organizing and will be an invaluable training exercise for Green activists around the country and is absolutely essential to achieve a national presence for the party. The Green Party and its 2020 presidential campaign will have to raise and spend $1 million to $1.5 million on such a campaign, far more than the Green Party's yearly entire budget for any of the last several years. It's a step up. It's a big step up, but it's got to happen. Number two, the Greens must begin to build effective, sustainable, membership-supported state and local Green parties by the summer of 2020. There was a moment after the Democratic convention in Philly when Bernie knuckled under to the forces who stole the election from him, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of activists briefly looked at the Green Party and mostly discovered there was no there there. The National Green Party, and I'm on the Green Party's National Committee, is unfortunately a feeble shell of what it ought to be. More than a dozen state Green Parties are barely functional, with minimal budgets and tiny mailing lists that haven't put 40 or 50 people in a room in years, even in states with multiple cities over a million in population. Not a single Green Party in the country, as far as I'm aware, maintains an actual office. In their current condition, a number of critical state Green Parties lack the capacity to undertake successful ballot access drives. They don't have the ability to launch credible organizing drives of any kind, and they have no prospect of raising the bucks needed to pay for the organizers, the training, and the tools to make it all happen. That will have to come from the Greens' 2020 presidential campaign, as the presidential campaign always raises and spends several times what the party does. Democrat and Republican parties are financed by Big Ag, Big Energy, Big Pharma, Pentagon contractors, Big Insurance, Big Real Estate, Silicon Valley, and assorted billionaires. Greens have tried the purest volunteer ethic. It's failed. It's time for the Green Party to adopt the universal, that is, universal outside the United States anyway, model of workers' parties and people's parties everywhere who sustainably and reliably fund themselves year after year with the dues of their own members. Number three, Greens need a 2020 candidate focused on obtaining national ballot access and building strong, viable, and sustainable local and national parties. Howie Hawkins, the longtime UPS worker and union activist who was the New York Green Party's gubernatorial candidate the last two times around, is one of the party's OGs, that is, original Green founders. He's been the most persistent and persuasive advocate of reimagining the Greens as an independent party with a dues-paying membership in the thousands and tens of thousands in every state. That's what the old Socialist Party had a century ago, until the Wilson administration took away their free mail privileges at the beginning of World War I. There are proven organizing models out here. They are cheap, but they are not free. Billionaires and foundations will not pay to initialize them or to sustain them. These organizing drives, these organizing methods, have to be put together and funded from the ground up. Howie Hawkins is the only one of the possible Green presidential candidates to acknowledge the scope of what his party must do in order to become a viable national force. And along with Green activists across the country, Hawkins is closely considering an exploratory campaign committee, the first legal step in a 2020 presidential run. Get ready for it. This is Bruce Dixon for Black Agenda Radio Commentaries.
My profound thanks for listening to the show. I want to mention my patron. I have one patron, the second fulfillment. Go to patreon.com, the Three Left Show, to support this show materially. Other housekeeping. Word of mouth is best. Please share the show with others who might be interested in this at all. And hearing alternative left-wing, left-libertarian politics. I'll definitely be covering more fun items next time. Let's see. Always leave reviews for the podcast. I don't think I've seen any. Maybe I need to check again. Maybe leave one myself. I still haven't. I just think it's pretty shallow to do that. But I guess but that helps the show get noticed, meaning it gets bumped up in the search bar. I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter. Check us out there. Every new episode, when posted, I post on social media. I did not live stream this week, but I hope to next week on YouTube. The YouTube channel is simply The Three Left Show. And any suggestions or advice or anything you'd like me to talk about is all welcome. We also have a full backlog of every episode on threelefts.news, www.threelefts.news. That is the website. I have a list of links to other Lefty Tube media and other podcasts that I have or do listen to, which I draw much inspiration from. And I might just be frittering away with this project myself. Is this building a base? Well, maybe a podcast itself doesn't, but I do this show in conjunction with community radio, and I do believe that if it is not ours, it is not ours. And we do need media to be informed, to take our place in social change. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much, beautiful people. This has been Dan Platt, Three Left Show. Good day.